Submarine telecommunication cables have been in the news a lot lately, with recent cable cuts in several parts of the world, most notably in the Red Sea recently in the spring of 2024. Now, this kind of activity isn't good for global communications, but it has given rise to a new interest in how submarine cables actually connect the world and give us the internet that we have today. Now, there are a little over 500 active submarine telecom cables right now, with new ones coming online soon, running longer distances, with greater capacity, and connecting more geographic areas than ever before. So it goes without saying that they are also a growing attack surface for bad actors in the world. My guest today is Doug Madori, no stranger to the podcast, and certainly no stranger to internet measurement and the analysis of submarine cable activity around the world. In today's episode, we'll explore what happened in the Red Sea, we'll discuss a little bit about how submarine cables function, how they're repaired, and we'll talk about some of the risks we're seeing today as they relate to submarine telecommunication cables. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Doug, thank you for joining me again. It's been a little while since you've been on the podcast, but certainly I'm really glad to have you back on. I read your blog post on the cable cuts in the Red Sea recently, and of course I've been keeping track of all of that that's been going on, that and other events as well, simply because of my interest and, of course, Kentik's interest in monitoring internet traffic globally. Very interesting. So I'm really glad to have you on. I would like to start off with a little bit of, we already know your background. The audience knows Doug Madori, but I'd like to get a little bit of your background, specifically in what you've been doing in monitoring this particular activity, cable cuts or global internet activity in general. And then I'd like to get into a little background about how these submarine cables are laid and repaired and just out there in the world.
Yeah, I've been doing analysis on the impacts of submarine cables for quite a number of years here, going back to my days at Renesas, looking at how do we see submarine cable activations and cuts. What are the impacts? Typically, when there's a submarine cable cut, it's a pretty violent event from an internet routing standpoint. There's a lot of reaction to it. One thing that makes this challenging is that packets aren't labeled what submarine cable they're on, or BGP routes. Most of it has to be inferred. And as years have gone by and we've added additional submarine cables in different parts of the world, that inference becomes more challenging because there's a lot more options. Actually, it's a good thing. It's the whole system is more resilient, but as an analyst, it becomes a more challenging prospect to try to tease apart which cable caused which event. But some highlights, some for cable activations, the Alba 1 cable to Cuba, the Kerch Strait cable to Crimea were ones that I spotted active more recently, was the SACS cable, the South Atlantic cable system that goes from Angola to Brazil. And then just this past year, the spur that was activated to St. Helena in the South Atlantic. Those are some examples of submarine cable activations. I was the first to publish some internet measurement data confirming their use.
I remember all your publications related to those. Very interesting. Has that been a major focus of yours, specifically because some of the activity that's been happening both with activations and with cable cuts in recent days?
Yeah. So the stories right now are about cable cuts. That's the opposite, the opposite, the flip side of the coin here. So we've got two major events that I've been digging into that are worth talking about cable cuts. And they occurred under very different circumstances, but they did also kind of occur on the opposite sides of the African continent. And so the first one was the one that took place in the Red Sea February 24th. So the background of what's going on there, we have in Yemen, there's been an ongoing civil war where the Houthi group has kind of taken Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. They've taken over most of the telecommunication infrastructure, and in retaliation for the war in Gaza, they've been launching missiles in the direction of Israel, and now most recently, since October, have been firing at passing ships that have some association with Israel, the United States, or Great Britain. There was some concern over, there was a posting on a Telegram channel of whether they were going to directly sever submarine cables going by Yemen. Because if you can, if you don't have the global submarine cable map memorized like I do, Yemen is on the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula, and that's where all the submarine cables that connect Europe and Asia have to traverse the Red Sea, and they go right by the strait between Djibouti and Yemen. And these cables are within their range. They're often within their territorial waters, and so there's some concern that they might do something directly to one of the cables. How they do that, it's a little unclear. But what ended up happening is there's been ships that have been shot at, and a couple that have been disabled, including this one ship, the Ruby Mar. That was hit with a missile. Thankfully, the crew was able to get rescued off of the ship safely. They dropped an anchor, left the ship, and the ship began taking on water, but didn't sink for a couple of weeks. And while it was taking on water and listing, it started drifting, and that anchor that it had sunk, had dropped, then started to cross the seafloor, snagging cables, and cut three of the cables that pass through the Red Sea. The Red Sea is a problematic area because it is a there's a couple of factors that make it problematic for submarine cables. And I've published analyses of submarine cable cuts in the Red Sea a few times in the past as well. And so you have fairly shallow water for an open body of water, like a large body of water like that. So it's just like only 300 meters or something. Mm-hmm. It's also heavily trafficked for ships passing through. You know, a lot of ships that are queuing up to wait their turn to come through the Suez Canal. So there's a lot of risk from anchors just in general.
Right.
There's also... you know, you have this high concentration of submarine cables that have to go between Europe and Asia. And, you know, we could talk about why that's the case, but it's that is just, there's economies of scale that make that the optimal route. And then those, sometimes they end up getting laid near each other because that's the optimal path due to the topographical features on the seafloor. And also, you know, sometimes these cables try to limit how much time they spend in the cable in the territorial waters of nearby countries. So in the event that they had to do a repair, then they'd like to be able to not have to deal with the local government, the permitting process that can sometimes slow down a repair process. But those factors then put a bunch of cables in a close space, shallow water with lots of anchors swinging by. So that's a very threatening environment. So then what's unique now is that you've got a hostile actor shooting at ships. Like if it wasn't already a difficult situation before, the ship's been hit, it finally sank, it took it down a couple of cables before it was gone. And we're not out of the water. This could happen again. The situation is not resolved, but anyway, so that's the Red Sea.
Right. And that's an important one to consider because there's a couple of different things to think about here. Number one, it is a high traffic area, but when you think about how, for our audience's sake, submarine cables are laid, they're typically going to make landfall near some sort of population center, though not necessarily like, you know, the middle of Manhattan, something like that, but it's going to be where there are data centers, some sort of a cable landing station, some sort of infrastructure to go from wet to dry and then bring that signal on land and do something with it. And of course, service providers can then go with it from there. And so it's inevitable that you're going to have that last few miles before landfall be, of course, it's in shallow water because you're in the last few miles before landfall. And there are protection zones. But it's inevitable that you're going to have these, I say inevitable, but it's highly likely that you're going to have incidents occur with that are unintentional, with ships' anchors being dragged or dredged, whatever the word is, along the ocean floor in those shallower areas, or fishing trawlers. And those are indeed probably the most common reasons that we have cable faults out there. Now, there are natural disasters and natural occurrences that are also a cause of cable faults, which we're going to get into as well when we talk about a different cable cut later on. But it's something to think about that this is not like an isolated incident. Cable cuts are happening all the time, really. And many of the cables that are out there are over 500 active in the world right now, are sometimes, often, maybe not often, but sometimes they're put into production in pairs or even in triplicates, into three cables. So you have those, that redundancy. Now, of course, there's a cost associated with that. So not all cables are. Now, you're talking about a very narrow body of water and shallow and geopolitically unstable area and missiles in the air. So you see, there seems to be all of these things conspiring together to make it a very dangerous place to put these cables. Can you talk a little bit about why they are there and not somewhere else that might be a little safer?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same reason that that's a common route, a trade route, why the Suez Canal was constructed to link the economies of Europe and Asia. That is the fastest way to route a connection between those geographies. And one might ask, why can't we do this over land? Because then you wouldn't have to deal with the water and the ships. And it turns out, actually feeding a line out the back of a ship is an easier proposition than dealing with all the things that come along with running a line through crossing borders and across terrestrial distances. So it may be easier to fix a terrestrial cut, but there's a lot of examples of why it's easier to just run a cable out in the ocean than to try to get a right of way between two destinations on land. I would add to you said a couple things here about obviously you're gonna what you want to land a cable near a population center, some sort of hub of connectivity. There's also other rationales where, once you go into a country's territorial waters, that country may have requirements for you to land the cable there because you're in the water and they have a say. And so if you were to pull up a map and look at Djibouti and say, wow, Djibouti must be the most popular place along this route for some reason. Well, it turns out that this is a requirement by their government. If you're going to pass through, you can't get through the Red Sea without coming back through their waters, and they want you to land. I'm sure there's some fees they can collect, and there's some advantages to that connectivity. Right. But yeah. So there's sometimes there are kind of non-obvious reasons why cables are landing in certain places. These cable cuts, this particular incident, has kind of brought up the resurface this concern around our reliance on this particular route through the Red Sea. It doesn't really go through the Suez Canal. There's cables that they typically come up on land and they go parallel to the Suez. And there's a project called Trans-Egypt, Telecom Egypt does, where they run in a mesh that goes across the land that pops out over on Alexandria in the Mediterranean. This has been an issue. I started going to submarine cable conferences maybe 12 or 13 years ago, and it was always a topic of like, how do we diversify this route and not have not just have all the same cables going the same route? And over the years, the other projects just haven't caught hold. There was a EPEG that went through Iran, and there was some complications around that. There was a Jadi cable that went through Syria, and the civil war there ended that proposition. I guess maybe GBI has got a route through Iraq. They just usually it for cost purposes. It's just cheaper to use the submarine cables. And this is a commodity business, moving traffic at the wholesale level that you would see on a submarine cable. So it's a very price sensitive thing. So the cheapest route is to do what everybody else is doing, which ends up pushing down the price, and it ends up being a submarine cable going through the Red Sea.
Yeah, ultimately we're leasing out slices of bandwidth and capacity to various folks on individual cables that might have multiple pairs of fibers to increase their capacity and serve multiple customers and therefore make some money. But, you know, here in this particular scenario, the one that we've been discussing so far in the Red Sea and with this ship going down, this is an interesting one because we like to say, oh, this is governments that are taking out submarine cables and there's war and all these things. But really, when it comes down to it, this really is an example of a ship with an anchor accidentally taking out this cable. That was not intentional, though that was the initial theory, wasn't it, that this was,
you know, I think initially there was a bit of a rush to
that makes sense.
Explain,
I would have jumped to the same conclusion.
It was the Houthis ended up cutting the cables. It just was that they shot a ship that dragged an anchor. So there was a couple more steps in the process. So ultimately, you know, the folks firing the missiles are the ones responsible for these cable cuts.
Right. So what kind of effect does that have on internet connectivity in that geographic region? I mean, are these the three cables? And I know from reading your blog post that one of them was already sort of out of service anyway. But ultimately, are these three cables and the source of internet connectivity for that entire region? Or are these a backbone between, you know, two different providers or two different areas?
Yeah, I would say they're very important. Thankfully, there are other cables. And this goes back to maybe the conversation, like what I was saying at the outset of just as an analyst who's been trying to tease apart submarine cable incidents for more than a decade, and that it gets a little harder as the more cables arrive. You know, we still have like CMV5. There's other major cables going along this route that can take up the slack. So you've lost some capacity, and I think they can try to light some dark fiber or get some routes that weren't in use or weren't used at their full capacity. There's enough slack in the system that after a couple of days, the engineers of the telecoms in this along this path could find alternate sources of capacity to keep the traffic flowing. There's not an infinite number of cables, so if this were to keep happening, if we had another incident of this magnitude, it could be really very problematic. Right at the moment, I think people have been able to shift their transit. And I guess when I started looking at this, I started to, you know, look at the country level impacts. Not just do we see a drop in traffic to a country, which I would classify as kind of a first order effect, but also looking at for the providers in the affected countries, how do their telecoms shift going from one transit source to another?
Right.
That's kind of a second order thing, a little bit more complicated, but it's something that we have got the tools to do here. And I find that kind of interesting because then you can get a little bit richer into the impacts. Once I started doing that, I started realizing, well, I think I could figure out which the timings of the specific cables going down, because they seem like they failed at different times. And so it was around this time that I joined up with Wired Magazine, who was doing an investigation into this using satellite imagery and AIS, which is like vessel tracking data, to try to use that to confirm the theory of the Rubimar, which I think most people in the industry and the submarine cable industry had settled on this being likely true. There may be some other facts that need to be surfaced to completely confirm it. But anyway, so I joined with Wired, and what I was sharing with them was looking at, we could see, for one, you know, so there's three cables. There's the EIG cable, the AE1 cable. Both of those go between Europe and Asia, and then CECOM, which is primarily a cable to provide service into the into East Africa, all the way down to South Africa. I just know from doing this for a long time. In fact, maybe going back to 2012, when there was another three submarine cables cuts due to an anchor in the Red Sea, CECOM is owned by, it's one of the owners is Tata, the global telecom giant out of India.
Right.
And so typically the owner likes to use their cable to provide their service. Obviously that's why they have this, bought the cable. And so that's usually a good tip off when you're trying to infer the timings of the cable cuts. So what I saw was, you know, a bunch of East African providers losing Tata service at the same time. And I was like, okay, that's probably, it's got to be CECOM. And then about 6 or 7 minutes after that, then seeing impacts along the path of AE1. As I said before, it wasn't public information, but EIG had already suffered a cable cut. In fact, they were in the process of trying to get a ship out to repair it when the Remark cut EIG a second time, and they're trying to get that squared away as well. So so then in the blog post we kind of published simultaneously with Wired Magazine, I tried to present some of the analysis and the data that I did, relying on either BGB data or some of the aggregate net flow that we have at Kentuck to look at, to tease apart the impacts of the different cable cuts. And I find that interesting. And it's also interesting that these cuts, I guess I can't see the third cut, so I don't know what the timing of that one, because there was no operational internet impact. But the other two were within 10 minutes of each other, which is different than the cable cuts in West Africa.
So then what data are you looking at in order to see what's going on? I mean, I guess that's a question for internet measurement as a whole, but in the case specifically of what's been going on in the Red Sea. And then how were you able to determine the timing of those cuts? What were you able to see in the data?
Yeah, like I said, I would look at transit for the big providers in countries along the path. So I guess for one, we could see a little dip in traffic for a handful of countries in East Africa. Also was visible in IOTA, the Georgia Tech Internet Outage Detection Service. So that's a public tool. And so that was another clue to say, like, all right, well, this is probably when probably CECOM had the cut. And so we can look at transit in BGP. So in BGP data, we'll see BGP adjacencies and see, look at the internet. How does the internet get to SimbaNet and through what transit provider, and how does that change through time? And so when you do that, then you can see those things are typically very stable, like there's no movement. And so when there is a change, the beauty of BGP data is that you can get down to the 1 second, level of granularity to really pinpoint when something's changing. And so those features, the changes kind of give away when there's something has perturbed the system. And in this case, we already kind of know that we're looking for impacts of a submarine cable cut ought to look a certain way. And here we are seeing transit providers dropping away or routes going to getting completely withdrawn. So I guess I've been doing BGP analysis for like almost 15 years now. So that's definitely one of the first things I go to. I know how to go through that data and look for the impacts. We've got some pretty good tools here that I can do this in mass. And then, again, with the net flow, I guess, is the other thing that we've got have a giveaway of impacts to traffic. Again, things ought to follow some sort of predictable diurnal slope throughout the day, and when there's a aberration from that curve, then there's usually a reason. And anyway, so that's another giveaway.
Right. Now, what about the, there was another cable cut that happened, not quite at the same time, but in early March of last year in West Africa, or off the coast of West Africa, the main one cable. That's something that you were able to see as well, right, in the data?
Yeah, so in that case, there's four cables. So there's a lot of broken cables within a couple of weeks. In that case, so this is is a different circumstance, and there was four cables cut on March 14th. Let me see if I can recall them. You mentioned the main one cable. There's a WAX cable, SAT-3 and ACE are the four. And so these were cut not due to a vessel drifting after being hit with a missile, but the prevailing theory within the industry is that there was an undersea rock slide off the coast of Cote d'Ivoire, and there is a I didn't know this about the geography under the water there, but there is a I'll get the French term wrong, but it's a trans sans fond. Like it's a bottomless pit. There's like a hole in the seafloor that goes down a couple of kilometers, and there's the ground around it kind of is on a slope down towards this bottomless pit, and so the belief is that somewhere along this slope triggered a rock slide, and and over the span of about 5.5 hours. Then these four cables all suffered catastrophic failures. And so then it's an interesting contrast to the Red Sea cable cuts where you've got, again, I only know two of the three failed within 6 or 7 minutes. In the case of Côte d'Ivoire or West Africa cable cuts, you've got four that failed in the course of 5.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And it likely has to do with, what's going on under the sea. And I talked to somebody who had been involved in laying of one of the, not one of those four, but another one of the major cables off the west coast of Africa. I try to tease apart because I don't have a lot of experience on the sea floor to understand, how like physics is a little different down there of just how things happen. And so in the case of, you've got a rock slide or undersea landslide that takes out a cable. Why would it be that it takes many hours to get all these cables to break? And there's like a few, theories from people who are more experienced than I am, who work with this stuff. One is that in a case like that, the breaks can get complicated. So you can have what they call a shunt fault. So some water breaks through the cable interferes with the electrical system. So there's, thousands of volts going across these cables to power the repeaters. And they can survive a little bit, a break at one point into kind of a limp mode, if you will. But then if anything else happens, then they're gone. And so you can have kind of degrading health of the cable over the time. And so I'm imagining something where you've got, a rock slide, you've got weight sitting on a cable and it's strong enough to take it for a little while, but not forever. And if it's certainly if it's suspended, if there's a suspension in the cable with weight on it, then over time that's going to be too much and it's going to cause it to break. But it is an interesting detail that is a different attribute between what took place in the Red Sea just a couple of weeks prior. I would add one more thing too, is that, this isn't the first time in the past, just in the past year, that there was a undersea landslide taking out submarine cables in the west coast of Africa. So in August, there was another incident, and we published some analysis digging into the undersea cable, undersea landslides that took out the subsea cables in the Congo Canyon. So in the Congo River comes out of the west coast of Africa, and for the last million years, it's been carving a groove into the seafloor of the Atlantic, and so it's created the largest undersea canyon in the world. And the canyon goes east west, and the cables all have to go north south. So they have to kind of cut through the cable, and it's just a precarious place for anything undersea, especially submarine cables. So we just had one in August that took out a couple other cables, and here we are again with another undersea event. And in that case, the two cables that were broken, I went in and looked at the timing of those, and they were about 10 hours apart. So it's even bigger difference. So it's interesting to just put yourself in your imagination on the seafloor, trying to imagine what, how these things are actually getting, severed. But, they're in the process of patching these things back together, but,
And it does take time. Certainly you are talking about the deploying repair ships. Now for the audience's sake, we are talking about fiber optic cables. And so we're talking about a core of fiber strands. It's very, very small. Everything else around that cable, which can be the size of a garden hose or perhaps a little bit larger, depending on, where it's laid and things like that, is protective sheathing. However, one of those layers is going to be the copper mechanism that provides power to the cable. These are active cables. What are we talking? Like something like upwards of 20,000 volts coming into the cable from both ends, from both cable landing stations, since they are home run on both ends. And so, you know, there's various types of mesh and steel mesh and other types of sheathing to protect from this kind of thing. And believe it or not, something that I've read in the literature and in talking to some folks over at Telegeography in particular is that it's safer generally in the deepest parts of the ocean because there's less stuff going on. You don't have ships' anchors and as much movement going on. And these cables can be submerged down to 7,000-8,000 meters in the deepest parts of the ocean. So it's very interesting what's going on as far as the technology. And then at the cable landing stations, when we're talking about rerouting and things like that, this is a manual process. I mean, there might be some automation involved. What I mean is that there is a process, a workflow involved in moving traffic from one physical cable to another physical cable at the termination points at the cable landing stations. So, you know, with over 500 cables out there and natural disasters occurring and rock slides happening and geopolitical instability, there are cable faults going on all the time. So I would like to move over now, Doug, to recovery and how that works. So who's fixing the cables? I mean, is it just Seacom sends a boat out? Do we have helicopters and divers? How does this work?
Yeah, so there's a small fleet of specialized ships that go out. They have to send a submersible down or try to snag the cable off the seafloor, pull it on the deck, and they've got a crew there to then assess the what's wrong with the cable, make a fix, and then gently push it back out the back of the ship. You know, in the case of the Red Sea, I mentioned in my closing of that blog post that the Minister of Telecommunications for Yemen, this is the Houthi government that's in control in Sana'a, I guess he's active on Twitter, and posted that just a reminder that any cable ships that were going to come in needed to get permits from their government and pay them for access to the waters, to their territorial waters, to do the repairs, and emphasized that this was for the ship's safety. And I couldn't help but kind of smile to myself, and I was like, yeah, maritime safety is definitely the passion of these guys. In the case of the Cote d'Ivoire cuts, those are estimated to be about 3 kilometers deep. So this is pretty deep. In fact, when that depth was first surfaced, so to speak, then that's outside of the range of an anchor. So that had to be something, you know, seismic landslide kind of thing on the sea floor. And those typically end up being harder to deal with. The greater the depth, the more the increased difficulty. Like I said, they've already got SAT-3 for whatever reason, which is the oldest and probably the least impactful cable. Seemed to be the first repaired. Maybe it was just the easiest to get to. It's all worked out ahead of time through contracting of who are the ships that are assigned to repair what cables. So this is there's a process when a cable goes into existence and operation, what ships are maintaining it. There's a prioritization order. Based on who owns the cable, then that may dictate which cable repair ship needs to come out and fix it. Right. And stop whatever it was doing prior, because these ships are not idle, really. They're always working on some sort of maintenance until they get called away to do a repair. And so then a lot of the time you wait to repair a cable, some of it is just the time it takes for a ship to sail from one part of the world to another. The fact that we had a bunch of cable cuts at the same time meant there's a whole bunch of work that needed to be done. I guess it wasn't so much of an issue that I think there was some concern there would be a logjam for cable repair ships. I think we've got a sufficient number, and I don't know that that was an issue. And then depending on the country or the territorial waters, you've got permitting processes that can be kind of headaches for the folks who do the repair work. Sometimes it ends up being a bureaucratic process. Right.
Yeah, the real life of the reality of undersea cables is a little bit more complex than the fiber optic you run in your data center. We're talking about path diversity, and I need to connect to two different providers outside of my campus. That's fine. That's easier said than done when you're talking about transcontinental subsea cables, multiple countries, multiple companies, web scale providers, Google, Meta, Microsoft. These companies have a vested interest as well. In fact, they're sure. putting out their own cables, or rather, when I say putting out, they're investing in the construction and the installation of their own cables. So it is much more complex than what we would do in our data center. And so we are talking about permitting. We're talking about geopolitical instability. We are talking about doing environmental impact studies. And then as far as repair is concerned, you mentioned that we have enough ships, but let's put a number out there. It's in the dozens. I mean, there's like 60, 80 ships that we have available in the world to do these types of repairs. Is that right? Or am I way off?
I'm not sure what the number is, to be honest.
It's not a huge number. I know that.
Yeah, a few years ago, I remember seeing a figure of like 40-something, but that's from maybe 2015, so there's probably more. But it's not, you know, it's less than 100. So and these are really specialized ships. Right. This is all they do.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you think about how are they figuring out where the fault is. You want to narrow it down, so you send the ship to the right location, right? You're not just going to go trace this thing, like you know, run a traceroute command, but you sort of are. You're using OTDR, optical time domain reflectometer. So basically, you're sending. I'm going to gross oversimplification is you're sending an electrical impulse or a network, you know, like a ping, right, down the line to see where, you know, and each repeater is going to send back a response, and you have repeaters every 50, 70, 90 kilometers, depending on what's going on, but around there. And so when you stop getting that response, you can narrow down where the fault is. And so you can't narrow down to like, you know, a square inch, but you can narrow it down to enough of a certain number of kilometers that you can send a ship to that location, pull it up and get to work.
Yeah, no, I think it's actually quite analogous to ODTR that you would use in a building. It basically blasts a light signal and listen for the reflection, and then they can just do a bit of math and figure out how far down the line. So I think on one of the cable notices somebody shared with me, you know, they mentioned that they were in the process of getting somebody to run some ODTR tests from the nearby cable landing stations to just isolate exactly where the get a good estimate of where the cable break is. But it's very analogous to what someone just working in fiber optics on land would do to identify where the break is.
Except for the fact that you need 712 permits from international bodies and you have to worry about missiles being fired upon your repair ship. That part may be a little different. And therein lies, some of the complexity, right? We are talking about this interesting blend of technology and advancing technology and a desire for more bandwidth. We are in networking, so we always want as much bandwidth as we can get. But also how this interplays with multiple countries vying for control and vying for connectivity and some sort of say into this entire tapestry of submarine cables that we have. The implications of these, though, are significant, right? So what other parts of the world would you consider sensitive beyond the Red Sea? And I don't mean in the ambiguous sense of like anything that's close to land because a ship can hit it. What other parts of the world have you seen as issues or potential issues for submarine cable cuts?
Sure. So in Asia, there's the Luzon Strait. There's a couple of bodies of water where it's really hard to avoid going through a certain spots. I think if you bring up a submarine cable map, you can see where those are. But in Southeast Asia, there's a couple of spots. And then you've got this added complication, too, of, again, back to the permitting, the bureaucratic process. So Indonesia has a bad reputation for being really slow on the permitting process. And so you've got cables that are, there's been cases that have been cables have been broken. The consortium's, losing $1 million a day or something. There's some very large amount of money till they get this cable back up and running, and they have to wait, for a month for someone to stamp a form. And then you've got also, the South China Sea is another geopolitical hotspot. We don't have a cable cut there, but that is another place where you could have a very strong geopolitical disagreement over who is. Whose water the cable is in. And so I think these days the cables going in that part of the world are trying to avoid as many of those situations as possible, because if you get a break and two countries vehemently disagree over whose water this is, it becomes no longer a technical issue. It's a political issue.
You mentioned the word consortium. Who are you talking about?
So a lot of these cables are put together with a lot of many companies. Often all of the, so like take the Simiwi series of cables. Those are, I'm not sure the number, maybe 20 or 30 telecoms have some sort of part ownership of the cable, and together they form a consortium, which is kind of like a legal construct for them to share in the governance and the costs and the profits of the cable. And that there's a whole science into how that gets done. There's typically, one or two major telecoms that are kind of lead the effort, and the others are there because they have, there's spurs that come out for cable landings in those countries, and then the incumbents of those countries want to be a part of the cable, they be a part of the consortium. So that's where that term comes. Not every cable is that way. The other model is that you've got a single ownership cable. So you mentioned Google and Meta. So like the Google cables, these are submarine cables that Google's putting the money up for and building, for their use, but they also will sell capacity like another submarine cable to offset the costs. In those cases, those are not consortium. They are the owner, but then they can, share the costs with the other people using the cable. But then that's a different model where, I'm sure people have different opinions of what's a more efficient way to do it.
And by cost, I mean, we are, it depends on the length of the cable, how many spurs there are, how many, how many kilometers long, because that does determine installation. It determines the amount of physical material. It depends how many fibers are you actually running? How many channels do you have?
Yes, the cable itself, the fabrication of the cable itself is the main cost. Yeah. That's far and away more. And then the path that you choose to lay your cable, how direct you can be from one place to another, how can you avoid different undersea threats or features. If you have to, go around something, that you're adding costs. So there's a lot of considerations. And then you'd like to have something that was a more direct path for lower latency. Maybe you might want to be outside of some territorial waters like we talked about earlier, but that may come at a cost of a greater distance of the cable. So these are all factors.
Right.
It's a complex endeavor.
Sure. And then the non-technical factors, like all the lawyers that you need.
There's a whole world of specialists that do different parts of this process of consultants.
Environmental impact studies.
Yeah,
probably cost millions of dollars. So the overall cost of a cable could easily, very quickly, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, this is normal. That's a normal cost.
Yeah, $400 or $500 million to do a transoceanic cable is a normal cost, and so it is important to find these ways to be efficient to maintain their usefulness for as long as possible, which from what I understand in the research is a couple of decades. 20, 25 years is the expected lifespan of a cable. So, which is why we have these repair ships and we do as much as we can. These organizations will deploy cables sometimes in pairs for that reason. Now, I know that the vast majority of internet traffic, and when I say internet traffic, I don't mean like, Doug, you and me clicking on a thing and then going to a website. Because a lot of that stuff today is delivered much more locally. CDNs and Microsoft is going to put POPs regionally. And so when I'm going somewhere, that information is co-located around the world. So I'm not going across submarine cables constantly, like me personally as an end user. But there's a tremendous amount of internet traffic, backhaul traffic, data center traffic among the cloud providers, among the web scale companies, all of that. And perhaps some of our traffic, if we're on St. Helena Island, right, where all of our traffic is leaving the island, is all traversing submarine cables. And only a very tiny percentage is traversing anything else, and specifically satellite. But I'm bringing this up because I just watched a documentary on Starlink and the latency that they offer, the bandwidth that they offer, and the fact that you can get connection in 7 continents, which for our listeners that don't know, are all the continents. Surely that has to be a viable option as a backup when cables go out and a region is completely offline, or maybe as a primary connectivity type. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, Starlink is a very impressive technology. It's very cutting edge as far as a satellite-based internet service, which I might add, you know, what did exist decades prior to Starlink and Elon Musk. I mean, it didn't first appear, but Starlink is a superior service by a lot of metrics.
Well, it's the difference between low Earth orbit and geostationary.
Yeah, so we've had geostationary for quite a while, and so then the next, you know, the three, you know, categories there, you've got GEO, MEO, and LEO. And so in the MEO category, the one company that was able to do this that's still in existence is O3b. And so in the it's an interesting, you know, transition between the three. So with geostationary, you can just put one satellite in one place. It's going to stay above a certain part of the world, you know, for the lifespan of the satellite. With MEO, so this between GEO and LEO, then you can cover the world with, you're kind of, it's like a compromise between the two approaches with about, like 60 or 70 satellites all in motion. And so then the, because the satellites are still kind of far away, you need a dish or something that can receive the signal, but also that satellite's moving. So the dish has to be able to move. So the ground stations for O3b service, which I believe is the only MEO service that's in use, you will have multiple dishes. They're tracking the satellites as they go by and they're handing off, which is this was a technical feat when this first came, a number of years ago, where they're handing off the signal from one dish to the other as one satellite goes over and then is out of sight and another one comes over. And so then the next phase down is like we're talking about with Starlink. And so these are what they call constellations of thousands of satellites all in low Earth orbit, where you need a fairly small piece of equipment that doesn't have to be tracking satellites through the sky and moving. It's far simpler technology. So it's a very cool thing. We see it, you know, in a lot of geopolitical stories, the war in Ukraine. Every time there's a shutdown of internet in a authoritarian regime country, you'll see people tweeting at Elon asking him to use Starlink to turn the service back on. So it's a hot topic for a good reason. But the one thing that anybody in this business would tell you is that the capacity is just not ever going to be the same. You cannot have, in fact, the capacity of the entire Starlink, constellation is less than what you would get on a submarine cable.
On a single submarine cable.
Right. So, it's hard to replace, what's, available via a fiber optic. I guess the other piece too is that, let's see. At one point, this has changed through time, but at one point, because with LEO, you've got lots of satellites fairly close to the Earth, you had to bounce back down. You're kind of relaying off the satellite to something in the general vicinity on planet Earth of where you're at, because they at one point there wasn't this ISL, so inter-satellite links, which now is again another piece of innovation from Starlink, of being able to you beam up to a satellite and then you can ping pong between satellites to get down to your other location. It's really, as a technical person in this space, it's kind of amazing. I remember talking to one of the engineers who was involved in this at a Nanog in the past, and he was just commenting on how they had to invent some new routing protocols of how do you you know, at least when we do routing, the routers stay in the same place. If your comm closets were all rotating around and you had to kind of constantly make decisions, on a per packet basis based on which satellite or which closet or, you know, switch rack is near you. That's a lot of complexity. And it seems like the challenge was, could you do LEO across the Atlantic Ocean? Because if you had to reflect down to a local ground station that was, there couldn't be one. It seems like they've been able to use ISL then to extend the range of the LEO constellation. It's pretty neat. It's still, as a business, it's still unclear. A lot of these projects have failed and gone into bankruptcy. And it's and as amazing as Starlink is, there's no guarantees for that project either. But it's still pretty cool.
Pretty cool. And I think it's clear based on, you know, what you just said and what we know about Starlink and others that are coming up like Kuiper from Amazon is that ultimately just doesn't provide the same. It's awesome for remote connectivity and for a lot of use cases. I've been looking at buying one for, you know, bringing camping. You know, it's a little bit expensive to have a monthly payment for just camping a few times a year. Sure. But nevertheless, that's something I've been checking out as a cool option for that specific use case. But for internet backhaul and for global internet access on that kind of a scale, global scale, not really there yet. You really can't compare with fibers in a tube. Under the water right now. The 2Africa cable itself, I think, is almost 200 terabits per second capacity.
Okay.
That's a lot.
Could be.
That's a lot of Starlink satellites floating around. It's not.
Yeah. And on the topic of Starlink, you know, with the ongoing war in Ukraine, so Starlink's been a big topic or subplot to that conflict and the connectivity of the country. And, you know, at one point there was, you know, some headlines saying, like, Starlink's keeping the whole country connected, which is not true. I mean, the most of the country is connected, again, through the fiber optic lines going out west from the country that were in existence prior to the invasion from Russia. But it can play a critical role of reestablishing connectivity in places where it's been lost, or in this military context. Again, as someone who did tactical comm, I get why this would be super useful. You've got units on the move. They can get this terrific internet service through a lightweight piece of equipment. So I think that's where that role has played. On occasion, it's been kind of clumsily rounded up to, oh, the whole country is running through a satellite or through a Starlink constellation. That's not really true.
So, Doug, I'd like to move on to a story that I heard, if you don't mind sharing.
Okay.
You at one point almost got a physical piece of a submarine cable. I've always wanted a piece. I've been doing a lot of research into this area for quite a while, and I would love to get my hands on one. I've checked eBay. You really can't buy just a chunk of submarine cable, but you almost did. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I was at a cable conference a number of years ago. I was on a panel with a gentleman from another I don't know if I want to name any names, but terrific guy. He was working with a Chinese cable manufacturing company, and they had a display at one of the Submarine Networks World in Singapore a few years ago. And I was like, how do I get one of those samples? Because at these conferences and all the booths, there's all these little mounted segments of cable. And and he's like, oh, I can get you one. I've known you for a number of years now. And I was like, okay. So we walked over there, and then the guys in the booth were like, get out of here. Like, anyway, I thought that guy was in charge. He was the boss, but it turns out he was not. It was the folks in the booth. So I'm still waiting for that the piece of cable one day. I make the joke that, you know, for some of these older defunct cables, it might be worth it just to pull it up out of the ocean, cut it up into 12-inch segments, mount those on wood and sell those for a couple $100, or I could just drive down, you know, the highway to the subcom plant in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and just rummage around in the trash outside the plant and see if I can find some pieces right. That they've discarded.
Yeah, because they're probably discarding transatlantic submarine cables in their outside
bunkers
for the local trash folks to pick up. It would be
barnacles.
I would love one of those behind my desk, in Zoom calls in my background, and
somebody's gonna wise up and satisfy this market need.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a really great podcast. I love talking about submarine cables, of course, in general, but also now tying it to what's been going on in the world, some really important events. So thank you very much for your analysis, of course, and what you do, but also for joining me today and talking to me. So before we end, though, of course, as always, how can folks reach out to you if they have a question, which some might on this particular topic, of course, how can they find you online?
I'm on Twitter, now X, and LinkedIn. Those are probably the best places to find me.
Great. And for the audience's sake, you're going to find a lot of Doug's writing on the Kentik blog. So I recommend that you scroll through there, search for his name. You can search for my name if you want as well, but search for his name and see his work there. You can also find me on Twitter, still very active there, network_Phil. You can search my name in LinkedIn, and you can find me online other places. Now, if you have an idea for an episode, or if you'd like to be a guest on Telemetry Now, please reach out at telemetrynow@kentik.com. So for now, thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.